Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
No one had heard anything like that. So I got to grow up in kind of this weird neutral American 80s idealized, world where we didn't know what was going on. I mean, the 80s to us was like, growing up in the United States, like, the United States is the greatest place in the world. Look at that. We've got Corvettes and hot girls and bikinis and Mountain Dew and, and so there was that. So when we were receiving like music, like from the UK and from Australia and from Europe and from who knows where else, we really hadn't heard anything like that. And if you were a curious kid in that region, I mean, it was, you got to really be your own person,
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
And this is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
Welcome to Curious Creatures, and it's, to me it's Wednesday night. I don't know what it is wherever you guys are, but we're in different continents. Please welcome Reggie Watts. Hello, Reggie.
Good morning.
Hey, Reggie. Hello.
Reggie's waving. And we're all doing signs and things, but nobody can see us.
Yeah. isn't that what Ice Spice was accused of the other day, Reggie? No, our audience can't see this, so,
Yeah.
On the Super Bowl, wasn't she accused of flashing, satanic signs or something? Ice Spice.
Who's that?
Ice Spice.
Who the hell's that?
Yeah, well, she was there sitting with Taylor Swift, so that tells you who Ice Spice is, right? Sort of.
Oh, she was giving satanic symbols or something like that.
Yeah, apparently on live TV, okay. On the biggest show to broadcast in the world. I don't know the veracity of that.
So. Well, good for her. I mean, if she did, good job. It's not easy.
So, Reggie, a good friend of mine. In fact, you had a band with him, John Tarja.
Yes.
How was it?
You mean the show or just working together?
Yeah, no, the show, because I never had a chance to talk to John too much about it yet.
Yeah. No, it was amazing. I mean, we always, now our shows aren't really like, we're not necessarily reproducing the tracks one for one. We're using the tracks as a base and kind of jamming on top of it. So it's always just a blast. It's just a jam, really.
Yeah. John's one of my favorite people. And I realized doing my due diligence on this that you both grew up, well, you both were born over in Europe, because he was born in Austria and you were born in Stuttgart, I believe.
That's correct. Yeah, that is correct.
They're definitely not too far from where I am right now, because I recognize them because they're kind of German.
Yeah. I'm glad you can feel it more than we can.
Yeah, I feel it. I feel that German thing going on outside. It's cold, it's wet, and it's dark.
I like that, personally.
You come into Berlin.
Yeah, I'm coming to Berlin, the 22nd of March, I believe. My birthday's on the 23rd, but I'll be in Europe before that. I'm doing some tour dates.
Okay. Berlin's waiting.
Yeah.
We're here.
I love it. I love it. I love Berlin so much.
You've been through here before many times.
Yeah. Every time I come there, I'm like so excited because I love techno, and they take their techno seriously, and there's kind of a social etiquette around going to clubs. You know, it's like you can do what you want to do, but you have to do it in a respectful way, or at least in a way that the society has, you know, organized it to be. And I really appreciate that. Like I like that. You know, it's like, yeah, you can do this, but you must do it over here, and you know, stay here is good, but you cannot do that here, you know, whatever. But it's like, it makes sense though. It's not like arbitrary.
Oh, you just reminded me of, I think it was the Berghain. I think I was playing there, or I was watching somebody there, and somehow I'd kind of fallen into the guise of, that people thought, I don't know why, I had a big kind of black puffer jacket on, and they thought I was security.
Oh.
But what I'm really good is, it was the end of the night, and the ambulance had pulled up outside, and something had probably gone wrong, you know, in the dungeon beneath.
Oh, no.
But it's typical, like, German efficiency, you know, it didn't matter what was going on down there. It was, you know, there was the Feuerstadt,
yeah,
flashing, yeah, lights, and
Krankenwagen.
The Krankenwagen.
I think I must have that look of, you know, like the policeman or security, you know, because if ever I go to any club, people try and give me their tickets and things, you know.
I love that.
To validate. I mean, I could make off with lots of people's IDs and stuff and just, you know. So I would have to confiscate this for a moment and just check it. You know. Then I could disappear out the back door.
Anything goes here. You just have to know where to go for what it is you want to.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's funny because sometimes the dance culture here is kind of weird. It's mostly lame, in that audiences don't really dance. They don't know how to, like, I don't know. They just stand around and, like, look at their phones, and, like, they're kind of clueless, or they're kind of, like, mildly moving or whatever. But then once in a while you'll go to a party. I mean, this was during the Grammy weekend, so maybe it had something to do with the Grammy weekend, but it was...
might have been the music.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, I don't know, something different happened. The crowd felt different. Like James Blake was spinning one night, and at Catch One,
yeah,
which is an old school club here. And he just destroyed, and everybody was losing it. Like, everyone's dancing, having a good time, and really moving. In the smaller rooms, people were moving. I think it has to do with, I think in LA, it's a better dance night if it's a queer night than it is just kind of a general night. I think that queer culture is more apt to just, like, yeah, we're here, let's have a good time and celebrate, whereas other people aren't as much.
Absolutely.
Have you seen the? I just got back on from a long flight, so I was watching too many movies. But the one I kept going back to was, it was Donna Summer's HBO Netflix thing.
Oh wow,
Polygram, and it was just lots of her growing up, and you know, and she started off. She was over in Munich, and then met Moroder, and I Feel Love.
Oh right, and, yes, yeah.
You know, so the beginnings of that. But then it cut to Studio 54, and Elton John was somewhere commenting in the background, but the camera was on him back then. But the dance moves,
yes,
and the lack of clothing,
yes,
and I just thought, they look like they're having a ball. And it was, she, you know, that music changed the scene, changed everything. But you're right. I mean, that's the gay scene knew how to move, and they had the best clubs. They had the best clubs.
Always the best clubs, just because they're just more likely to take advantage of the fact that they're in a club with the DJ, and whereas the non-queer, whatever that is, like, I think people are there to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm in this place now.
That's what happened over here, you know, when we all started. I remember Susie telling me about, what were they called? Shagaramas or something like that, you know, and she used to work host, like, in one of the clubs. But it was the gay clubs that would the only places that you would be safe as a young punk.
Ah, that makes sense.
If you were a model for, like, I don't know, Vidal Sassoon's hair salon, like Susie stepped in there a few times, you know, so she'd get her hair done kind of strange. I'll be your guinea pig for the new do, you know, the new look.
Right.
And then you go out. But it was only, it was the gay clubs. It was also the strip joints. And this is where, like, the Sex Pistols could play.
Yeah.
Because nobody else would have them.
Interesting.
But you were safe-ish. You were safe. As long as it wasn't like, you know, the big boys' night when the you know, the big stilettos were out.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, 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 of course. Yeah, they're like, this is our place.
There was a lot of, you know, crossover between all of that at the beginning of punk and stuff. Because I can remember going out to all the clubs, and it was only places like Heaven and like the fetish clubs that would have you, like, if you looked a bit punky, because, you know, everywhere else they'd say, oh, no, that's not the dress code here. You can't come in, you know. And that was really what changed as well when it got to, like, a bit further along with like, you know, the goth thing with the Batcave. Because the Batcave, you could come in, didn't matter what you looked like, you know. I mean, a lot of people looked outrageous, and some people didn't.
They were around the corner from each other, weren't they? In Soho, yeah, in London.
Absolutely, yeah. You could sort of stumble from one to the next, yeah.
Madame Jojo's.
Yes.
Man, was the Batcave, was that an actual club?
Well, it was inside another club, yeah, but it was definitely a club, yeah. And you had to walk through a little coffin to get in the front door, like, you know, when you came out. Seriously.
Oh, I love that.
Knocked it out. But when you got in, it was like the whole ceiling was like really low, so it looked a bit like a tomb. But, you know, there was plenty of people who looked like, you know, gothic, but not everybody, you know, as long as you wanted to come in and enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
So that was like one of the exceptions to that rule, because I agree with you about the, you know, like if you go to a gay club, people are more apt to dance and stuff, and that was one place where it was like it was like that, you know, already.
Ah, the big one.
Heaven,
the big
yes,
one
heaven
was Heaven.
Big one.
Yeah. That was just the best. Heaven was like several dance floors underneath the arches down at Charing Cross.
Ooh. Yeah, still there.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Okay, I got to find that next time I'm in London.
You got to go down there.
Back in the day, getting into Heaven, it was actually like going to get into Heaven, because the area around it, you know, you were liable to get stabbed or beaten up or whatever if you were going to, you know, walk out after 8 o'clock, you know.
That was just a par for the course, wasn't it? It was just like that was...
Well, it was part of it, yes, exactly. But now it's like, it's very gentrified around there, so it's very, very safe, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But used to be, we had to go like four of us at a time. Otherwise, you know, one of us facing each way, you know, west, east, north, and south, because otherwise you're going to get jumped.
Right.
You know, so.
Damn. Heavy.
This is my burning question, Reggie.
Yeah.
How did you end up in Montana, of all places? Because I have... Over 40 years, I have probably played, well, I have, I know, I've played in every state of the Union except Montana.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to know how you ended up there.
Well, there's an Air Force base there. My dad was in the Air Force, and so they had a choice of being stationed in North Dakota or Montana, and they thought that Montana had a better school system, so... That's
it.
Yeah, pretty simple.
Always the answers are always pretty simple, right?
I know, man.
Is your book just coming out, Reggie? Is it published now?
Yeah, it's out. October came out.
Yeah. I had a little dip in there. I love the way you kind of just move in and out of the different languages you met. So were you in Barcelona or was it Madrid? I can't remember.
I think it was outside of Madrid. Something Inaris.
Yeah.
Something Inaris. Was the area? I don't know.
You were really small, and you were going around with your dad, and your dad was talking, and you were talking, and your dad knew like different lines for different bars or something, and it was kind of like choice, almost kind of how to charm everybody, I suppose. But no, it was just that I was wondering how it affected you. What part of it has stayed with you? What? Or was there some aspect of that that formed who you became in many ways?
Well, I mean, I think, like, you know, when you're that small and you're kind of, you know, in sponge mode,
yeah,
you know, you're soaking up a lot of tiny details that, you know, that I might not even be aware of, you know, but they were details. And I think so. Absolutely. 100%. I mean, I remember, you know, kind of some images of Madrid in my head. And I remember I think there was a show. Oh, it was a Red Bull Academy, had a, one of those Red Bull Academies in Madrid. And so I wanted to go to Madrid. So I did. And I brought my new girlfriend at the time. And we went to Madrid. And I was really excited about it because I wanted to see if I could get some of that feeling back from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And kind of a little bit, but I just have like these like memories of a kid, like of what Madrid felt like and looked like. And some of it might also have to do with like Super 8 footage and things like that. But like, So, I mean, definitely 100%.
Does it come back as a kind of patchwork, you know, like some things are definitely in focus, other bits kind of, it sounds like you remembered key phrases as well, or you could just, somehow you were slipping into Spanish and then maybe a bit of German.
Yeah.
It's almost like no distinction. It's all part of the language you were growing up with. It was like multicultural.
Yeah, it's like general language, you know, like general language. It's like doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it sounds, there's bits and pieces that might, you know. But it's fun. It's fun to mirror it back, you know, in that way.
It's like because you were touring as a little boy.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
We all had to, we had to wait until we're a bit older, you know, tour locally.
That's true.
You were kind of like jumping across borders and picking up the lingo.
Yeah.
It's funny. I'm intrigued about what you were saying about language because a little while ago we had a guest on Pan Amsterdam who actually you know sang on one of the tracks of an album that me and Budgie have just done.
Oh, sick.
And he said sort of the same thing, you know, because we were asking him about, you know, because like he did this big long rap on it, which is brilliant on this track, and we're like, well, where did that come from? You know, what are the elements? And he said some of it was about him being a very young teenager, you know, to the just before sort of like you had any sort of awareness of the outside world, and some of it was about now. And he would, you know, once I understood that, then I could be sort of flung around the whole track and feel like the different aspects that you're looking at stuff, because I think words are, you know, and I'm going to state the obvious here now, but they're so very important for giving you the idea of what an artist is about and how they're about. Because, you know, I've always used words in any way just to paint a picture, but it may not be that obvious unless you have one or two clues. So sometimes they appear more mysterious, I guess, than you really want them to be. But I don't know, as I'm getting older, I'm learning to become less obtuse, you know, and perhaps a little bit more obvious, you know, just because maybe because there's less time to be obtuse, you know. It's like if I'm not going to tell you what I think now, maybe too late down the road. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, that's the way I feel about language. But I was going back to Montana. He said skishing around the whole thing. As far as what I understand, Montana with the big sky and everything and that has to have some effect. I mean, you know, for me, like, so when I first came here, one of the first things that I really liked and discovered was the desert, because the desert is like open and, you know, everything is like sort of infinite when you're looking up at the sky and things. So where does that come into your artistic practice, I suppose?
You mean like the Montana effect?
Yeah, the Montana effect, the red dog effect that we're talking about. Where does that come into it? Or doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, Montana definitely, I think there's a groundedness to it, to having more of an upbringing in a, you know, I guess it's not totally rural. I mean, it was a city of 65,000 people, but, you know, I mean, you can see the mountains around you. You can see the country around you.
Right.
It only takes 10 minutes and you're out of town. So,
right.
You know, I think that there's definitely a ruggedness. Plus, I grew up in the best time to grow up, which was the 70s and the 80s.
Right.
There's, you know, I don't, you know, we didn't have cell phones and synthesizers and pop culture. And, you know, there were so many music genres that were being invented that had never been heard before.
Right.
And now everything's like, oh, that kind of sounds like this. And that kind of sounds like this. And that kind of sounds like this. Right. Whereas before, if you would have heard, I don't know, something like, you know, Joy Division or something like that, you're like, what is that? I don't quite know what that is. I guess it kind of sounds like rock and roll, but I'm not totally sure. Or, you know, or even like, you know, Susie and the Banshees, which, you know, Susie Sue is like one of my probably top five favorite singers of all time. And I always thought like, wow, like these types of musics that are being generated for the first time, like for instance, like Peekaboo, right. You know, like that song alone, like no one had heard anything like that before.
Yeah.
It kind of used sampling elements of some hip hop kind of elements to it, but all that reverse work and the reverse horn sounds and things like that. And her commanding vocal presence and like, no one had heard anything like that. So I got to grow up in kind of this weird neutral American 80s idealized, you know, world where we didn't know what was going on. I mean, the 80s to us was like, you know, growing up in the United States, like United States is the greatest place in the world. Look at that. We've got Corvettes and hot girls and bikinis and Mountain Dew and, you know, and so there was that. So when we were receiving like music, like from the UK and from Australia and from Europe and from who knows where else, we really hadn't heard anything like that. And if you were a curious kid in that region, I mean, it was, you got to really be your own person, you know.
Wow, that's a wonderful memory. Goodness. It's funny because when you say Peekaboo and Peep Show and the album and everything, I was talking about just this morning, and it's that the experimentation that went on in the studio, and we tried many different ways of trying to get that song to work, and it really by accident, and that whole reverse tape stuff, which Susie would want on every, you know, performance. She wanted reverse echo. She loved that. That kind of hit a wall and then the voice started.
Yes.
And we just, and that's how it came about. Just we were doing on the album previously, and then it was all the brass section from another track, which was actually with John Cale, a John Cale song.
Wow.
And it was just everything led on to the next thing. But when we got to like America thought, oh, it's going to be really cool, they didn't get it, you know, most places.
Right.
The Weenie Roast on MTV, just, it was too odd for them. The video probably was banned, probably for too many, you know, too many edits. Usually that was the excuse by the BBC. But the video for Peekaboo got an award, but it was really only a small award.
Interesting.
You know, like the Channel 4 award for quite smart video.
Wow.
Certainly no Grammys. But we never got nominated for any of the, you know, the joy we spread to the world and those vast plains of Middle West America.
Yeah.
That's the experience of a lot of American artists that, you know, that I know or talk to. Like Trent Reznor, he told the same thing. He said, you know, like, I was living in this place which was like Mercer, small town, USA, out in Pennsylvania, he said, and it was like, all there was like cornfields for miles, you know, but the radio, because I had a lot of, you know, it was college radio in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
He said that gave me something different was coming out of there, and what is this, you know, so that triggers thing. I like to think, with the whole thing with like, you know, the UK and the USA, there's like this sort of symbiotic thing, because every generation, it kind of turns around and it becomes, it becomes like, hey, now we're going to show you what we do, and you're going to take a bit of that and distill it, and then you're going to throw it back at us, and it goes round and round like this big circle. It's a bit like, you know, one of these ocean currents coming, you know, across the Atlantic, keeps going round and round. But it's very interesting to me, all of that, you know, just to look at that and see how it feeds on itself, you know, which is great.
I mean, it was, you know, for me, like, you know, when I remember seeing, I think, The Cure Just Like Heaven, you know, the video for it on 120 minutes and seeing that for the first time. And I was like, what is this? Like, I don't know what this is, but
what was that video? What happened in that video?
They're on like a cliff's edge. They're all playing on the kind of like this, obviously in a studio, but like, it looks like they're on a cliff. And
No. It was on a cliff. It was on a real cliff. We did it on a real cliff. No, we didn't. Of course, it was in a studio.
was it a misty blue cliff? Was Robert discovering rocks?
Yeah. He was, you know, he was mystified at the horizon. He was staring into the horizon a lot, you know, just like really yearning for something.
That's right. I remember that one. Was the wind blowing gently through his hair?
Of course. Yeah, it had to, you know. And then his keyboardist was playing very, like, cute and lackadaisically. It was great.
Yes, Roger.
But, I mean, those are, like, it's funny because those, like, you know, like, Susie and the Banshees, you know, was such a huge staple of my friend's culture. You know, like, you know, all the girls loved Susie. All the guys loved Susie. You know, it's like everyone loved it because it was something radical and something definitive, you know, like, and it was ceaselessly itself, you know, and I think that's what attracted all my friends to the punk music that we were into, and, you know, any of the Dead Kennedys to, you know, whatever, Cabaret Voltaire, and, like, you know, weird things, whatever, like these kind of like post-punk and punk groups. And I think, like, all of that was huge because I created a culture for us that we could join in, even though we were like just like this tiny crew in Great Falls, Montana. There were probably tiny crews in all kinds of cities all over the United States.
Yes,
there were all huge fans of, you know, the British music. But I mean, also,
Susie attracted the oddball.
Yeah,
she attracted the gay scene. Yeah. the outsiders, the people who didn't connect, who felt left out, And they were down there in the front row, you know, always when we came to America. It was a party, every gig.
Man.
And it was great.
Can't imagine.
I just remembered, you just reminded me of something, Budgie. One of the first times we played out on this side, probably early 80s, 80, 81. We played our first show ever in Salt Lake City, and we played it out. The promoter didn't know where to put us, so we were in this big rodeo place out in the middle of nowhere. And I swear, every outsider over the whole of Utah turned up that night. I mean, it was like, it was unbelievable, but they nearly wouldn't let us in the gig because we got stopped at the gate coming in, and the security guy was like, "So who have you got in the car?" You know, we were traveling with the promoter. He said, "Who have you got in the car?" And he said, "I've got the band." And he looked inside the car and had a look at us all and went, "They don't look like a band to me. They don't look like a band to me." So he nearly wasn't going to let us in.
What?
You know, it's like, yeah,
because that's not the Osmonds. No, come on, get out of here. That's a band.
Yeah, exactly. We look completely different. But it was one of my favorite gigs we ever did because everybody went nuts.
I'm sure you keep mentioning this gig in Salt Lake City, and we played some gig in Salt Lake on some tour, and it was outdoors, and it was on a wooden, big wooden stage thing, and there was hardly anybody there. And no, there was quite a crowd there, but the thing was weird was we were playing the same set that we'd played each night, and usually by about halfway through, I'm soaked. But I wasn't wet. I was sweating, but nothing was happening.
Ah, yes.
Wow, because it was so dry, so hot.
Yeah, so very dry.
Yep, exactly. I was turning into a salt lake. My stool.
Real-time evaporation.
So, yeah, real-time. So, like, you know, usually the curse of the drummer is the wet arse.
Yes, of course.
Well, the wet hands as well. The sticks fly out.
Wet hands and damp bottom. And they were dry. As far as I could see, you know, the hands were dry. I didn't have time to investigate.
Yes.
But it was that. It was so, and then totally dehydrated. But what did you do? You hit the bar. There's not a drink in sight.
No drinks.
Because at that time in Salt Lake, you went to the hotel bar and you couldn't see it. There's no booze on view. I said, what would you like? I said, well, what have you got? I said, well, you have to tell us. And he had a drawer, and when he pulled open the drawer, there was like a little miniatures of like, you know, small whiskey, small vodka, and they would pour it and put that thing back in, and you never saw them.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's weird.
That's crazy.
Now it's full of microbreweries and stuff. It's like,
yeah,
just like anywhere else, but it was odd.
The other thing I remember that was odd, that the dressing rooms for the rodeo gig were the places where they kept the horses, so they had a mud floor.
Oh my God.
You know, so that was great for our wardrobe, you know. It's like, yeah, you boys get back in here in the mud floor place, you know. But
this is where the Cure of the Banshees, we must have drifted apart. You guys talking about, you know, flying and dressing rooms, and we were still like on the bus
on the road again. Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so hilarious. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think, like, you know, essentially emerging from a punk scene and creating this kind of like post-punk world, kind of using the spirit. It's like the spirit of punk, but like extended into this kind of more world-building kind of thing.
Yeah,
that it would become like one of the most dominant forms of music, you know, which is insane, because like I would say, definitely, I mean, it's not just blowing smoke or whatever, but to me, like The Cure, Susie and the Banshees, Bauhaus are probably some of the most important bands of rock and roll history.
Wow.
Because they informed so many other bands. Like, you know, I wouldn't probably be as creative, at least when I was younger, if I hadn't heard those bands, you know. And I mean, there are other bands like the Go-Betweens and, you know, Crowded House and things like that, but like,
right,
for me, those bands, especially Bauhaus with its super dark, like just crazy experimental, you know, it put you in this zone as a kid where you're like, what is darkness? Yeah. You know, like, you know, you're thinking about like, yeah, what is darkness and why do I love it so much? And then to have a whole scene of people who are like equally interested in it. I feel like you can't really go back to goth, you know, like you can't, like, I think it's harder to become an adult and then go, now I know what that is, you know, maybe because I feel like I kind of grew up with it, you know, at least in my teens, and it really informs. Like, if I'm playing a show live, I can go and do something that feels dark and gothic, and I'm not imitating it. I'm channeling the spirit of it, and that brings a certain fandom to my, you know, people that they feel like, oh, they can trust me. Like, whenever I go to, like, you know, Darker Waves or whatever these festivals.
I think you've kind of coined it. You've summed it up, because when you're in it, it is all consuming when you're performing. And today again, I'm doing a little memoir as well. You know, so I'm talking,
yes,
with my editor. You know, who's helping to draw this stuff out, and we're talking about Juju and Night Shift and Into the Light, and it's a pretty gothy album, you
yeah.
know. It's got a lot of dark storyline undercurrent to it, you know. And things that actually happened in Britain at the time, like the Yorkshire Ripper and young girls getting vanished. And we were on tour around Britain around that time, around the place that he was operating, and there was fear in the air, you know, and parents fearful for their daughters coming out, you know, not like in an Iron Maiden kind of way, to, you know,
right.
Yeah. But it was real, and yet as you kind of put your finger on it, there, it was it's kind of what wasn't easy for us was when you get onto MTV and they go, so what's it like? What's it about? What gets your guys going? You know, and I remember Robert as well. We would do anything but say we're goth or we're this or that.
Of course, you can't do that,
because you couldn't talk about it. And almost it was weird, because the audience were more serious about it. They were much better looking. You know, they'd always spend hours, weeks preparing for when you came into the town, and yeah, they had like great clothes, and we just kind of fell off the bus, feeling a little inadequate at your own party, you know.
Yeah, it's still there though. The whole thing, it's still there. Like, you know, I tell people, you know, I go into any small town across America, and I can spot the 5 or 6 kids who are going to be into that, even if they don't know it yet.
Yeah,
you know, that's who they're going to be.
Yeah,
it's pervasive, really. Still,
yeah.
Curious Creatures is presented by Lowell Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio design, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Associate producer and digital marketing, Marge Taylor.
Visual designer, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jack Knife Lee.
Assistant editor, Ben Miller.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2024.